Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to this 38th episode of Step Into the Light on this Tuesday morning, November 22nd. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Patty Sheen. On this show, we introduce listeners to people who have found their way out of the dark shadows of life and back to light, and those who, through personal dedication, faith, and determination, lead others on their journey from darkness to light. Today's guest, Tiffany Amber Stockton, has been crafting and embellishing stories since childhood. She has honed those skills to become an award-winning author and speaker who works in the anti-aging and wellness industry as well. She writes both contemporary and historical fiction, specializing in character-driven stories that focus on relationships and family legacies. Three of her 20 books have won annual Reader's Choice Awards. She lives with her husband and fellow author, Stuart Vaughn Stockton, along with their daughter, son, and a retriever mix named Roxy, right here in Colorado. Welcome to the show, Tiffany.
Thank you so much, Patty, for having me on your show this morning. It is a great pleasure to be here.
Well, it's just great to have you here, and I know that you're clear across the country. You happen to be on vacation right now, so you're not in Colorado at the moment.
No, you are definitely right. Yes, it does let us connect, even though we're 2,000 miles away, and yeah, I'm clear across on the East Coast and visiting with family and getting ready to celebrate Thanksgiving, and so yeah.
Well, that's exactly what you want to do with the holidays is be with family, so I'm so glad that you're blessed to be able to do that, Tiff.
Well, oh, you and me both.
I'm fortunate in that, well, my husband's family is out here. My family is actually there celebrating in Nashville this year with my sister and brother-in-law celebrating with their daughter in Nashville this year and her husband. So yes, that's kind of neat.
Nashville, okay. So that's not too far away.
I'm sorry?
I said that Nashville is not too far away from where I am and over in Virginia, and most of my family is here in Virginia. Well, at least my side of the family is here on the East Coast because that's where I grew up, and then my husband's family is all over in Colorado, so that is what drew me out there.
And how funny. I don't know why I always think of you as a Pennsylvania girl. Isn't that weird? I don't associate Virginia. It's just strange. I don't know why.
Yeah, it is probably a bit of my accent because I was born outside of D.C. and stayed kind of in the Mid-Atlantic area. So there was a lot of influence from Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, and so you can definitely detect that East Coast accent in me when I talk. So a lot of people probably associate Virginia more with a slightly more southern accent, being
yes,
where it's located. So,
well, anyway, in the long run, I'm glad that you're able to be back there with family in the East at this time of the year. Tiffany, tell us, how did you begin your writing and speaking career? Is this something you had wanted to do since you were a small child, or did you kind of grow into it as you got older, or what's the story behind
the
story here?
speaking and writing is definitely not anything that I myself set out to do. I would say even growing up, well, looking back now, they always say that hindsight is 20/20, and when you look back at your life, you can kind of sort of see where certain things were falling into place if you had either, been more mature, if you had had other people speaking into your life, or if you had paid more attention to some of the signs, some of the guiding that was happening. And for me, I've always been a writer, I guess, now that I look back at it, but it was more for hobby. It was more for expression. It was a lot of just kind of getting my thoughts down or even just having fun, and I dabbled in some stories and things. I never really thought it was going to go anywhere, and so I just sort of, I didn't really pursue it much. And with speaking, the same kind of thing. I've always been fairly good at making my, presenting my thoughts and imparting them over to people. And even when I was in school, I was called upon often to give the answers to the questions or to come up and do an oral book report or whatever it was that was something that was speaking. And so I've always had kind of a confidence when I've done any kind of speaking. But again, it really, I never really put two and two together. And I went on to college and I pursued my teaching degree because I loved working with children. I loved teaching. And so I taught after college. I taught for a few years. I did second and fifth grade. And so I, you know, I really didn't get too much into it there in my 20s even. There was a one point that I can definitely remember. There was a, at the church that I was attending at the time, I had been in that church for probably about 12 years at the time, and there was a women's group that had, one of the ladies of the group, of the leader, had approached me and had asked me just to kind of come and just share my story with those ladies, because I am one who, I've always been raised in the church, I've always had a good, solid faith family background, and so, and I've never, ever had a point in my life where I have walked away from God. And so that particular message was something that the leader of this women's ministry at the church wanted others to hear about, well, what is it like having that kind of faith? And so I had gotten all prepared, and I had was ready to share that. And right before I spoke, there was another lady in the group that kind of pulled me aside. She was very well respected in the church. She was somebody that a lot of people looked up to. And she pulled me aside and she just sort of, and I'm thinking, okay, well, she's just kind of going to give me a little bit of encouragement maybe and, you know, give me a couple of words of wisdom. And, but instead she looked at me and she said, I have no idea what kind of boldness you have or who you think you are, but coming here and speaking to these ladies and thinking that you have something that to offer them when you are so young and you haven't even lived life yet. And these ladies are all older than you, and they have they're mothers and they're wives and they've had careers and they've been, you know, they've had all these experiences, and you're coming here and you're fresh out of college, and now you think you're going to have some kind of wisdom to offer women who have walked far longer of a life than you have. And so, you know, you're too young to offer anything to anybody. So I don't know who you think you are. And
wow.
That, oh my goodness. Yes. Yes. I know it really, it shocked me. And even looking back now, I mean, I got through that little presentation. I did share my story. It probably was not as strong as it could have been because I had that lady's words playing in my ear and playing in my mind. But that went on for 15 years to just kind of stall me from any kind of speaking. And it really just stopped me where I spent that 15 years from that point forward just doubting myself and preventing God from working through me. And so I didn't even allow anything like that to work, you know, as far as speaking. And so even though I still shared my wisdom with people and I still went on, the speaking really didn't take off until, you know, until I was in my mid-30s, I guess. And, you know, writing has a whole other story, and where my writing, as far as the professional side of things, began probably, the seeds began back sometime in the 90s when I was talking with a favorite author of mine, Tracy Peterson, and this was back before email and websites and the internet and all of that. And so I was handwriting some letters and getting some letters from her, and throughout the 90s we kept in touch. Email, internet came up, websites came up, and early 2000s she just, through all of our different dialogues back and forth, she realized that I had a little bit of writing, so she had asked to see it. And, of course, I dealt with a lot of doubt and uncertainty again, where somebody is as important, and at least somebody that I had put up on
Tracy.
A pedestal, is Tracy Peterson. Yes, and I'm thinking,
who's
wow,
written like about 150 books?
Something, yeah. She has
those,
something like, I know she's got over. Yeah, she's got over 100 books, I know. But, yeah, so she's definitely an author that is very prolific, and I love her books. I love, you know, what she writes. Most of what she writes is historical fiction, and she does have a few contemporaries out there, but she's definitely got a very, very long-lasting career. And so she encouraged me to join this group called ACFW, what is now American Christian Fiction Writers. When it began, she was one of the founding members, and it was American Christian Romance Writers. And this was in 2002, and I'm thinking, why do I got to join this writers organization and all of this? And a lot of my writing, my writing basically came about very, very non-traditionally in terms of I had no idea what I was doing when I got into writing. It wasn't something that I had, it definitely was not something that I had planned. And I kind of allowed Tracy to guide me into it. I joined this organization. I went to their first conference. I met other writers, which opened my eyes to a world of other people that love to jot down their thoughts and share stories and craft stories and had fun with that. And I went to the conferences. I sort of started to learn a little bit about writing. And then 2 years later, I still wasn't doing a whole lot. I just sort of was dabbling a little and kind of testing the waters. And then in 2004, right before the conference in 2004, Tracy had emailed me and she had said, you know, I would like to give your writing, that stuff that you sent me, I would love to give it to my husband. Is it okay? He loves history and everything, and he would love to read it. And I'm thinking, why in the world would your husband want to read something I've written? But again, I sort of just let it happen, and I said, yeah, sure, show it to your husband. Now what they didn't tell me at the time was she and her husband both were currently acquisitions editors for Barber Publishing. And so they were actually looking for some new authors. And I had no idea that this was something running through the back of their minds, that maybe possibly some of my writing could be kind of crafted and honed and modeled and manipulated a little bit so that it would then possibly become an author. And so I'm just having this conversation with one of my favorite authors and her husband, not even realizing where it's leading at the time. And So I'm thinking, sure, go ahead, show it to your husband. And then at the conference that year, I actually met Jim face-to-face. I'd met Tracy 2 years prior, and I met Jim, and we started chatting, and he bumped in a little bit later. He bumped into me in the hall, and he kind of nudged my shoulder and said, go check your email. And I'm thinking, why in the world would he tell me to check my email while I'm at a conference? So I did, and I went over, and sure enough, there was an official request for a proposal in my email. And I'm going, a proposal? What's a proposal? And I'm thinking, okay. And so I'm quickly going through my notes and going through the stuff that I had learned at the conferences so far. And I'm thinking, okay, I got to write a proposal. All right. Oh, okay. So that's so I got to do this. So then I started understanding a little bit about that, and I put that together. And then I ended up sending it to him, and it took us another 2 years, really, of back and forth where he had asked me for that proposal. I sent that to him. Then he asked me for the full manuscript, did the research, got that done, sent it to him. And then he sent me that full manuscript back. And there's a terminology that a lot of writers will talk about there, where they get their manuscripts back from an editor and it's just bleeding. And they think that their stories have just taken a slow, agonizing death from all of the red marks that are on the manuscripts. And I can tell you that is exactly what happened with that manuscript that I sent to Jim. And he came back, and But then he knew I had received it, so he immediately followed it up with a phone call saying, I just want to reassure you, you don't need to be upset. You don't need to go throw the manuscript in the trash. I know that you're probably in shock over all the red, but he walked me through the process and coached me through the process and guided me, and the two of them have become amazing friends. And in 2006 was when I got notified at the conference, ACFW, and I was kind of told then there was all kinds of restructure happening with Barber Publishing, and Jim and Tracy were actually stepping down as acquisitions editors and all kinds of stuff that were going on. I found out probably 2 months later that I would have been rewarded my contract or awarded my contract there at the conference in 2006 had the restructuring and everything with Barber Publishing not been taking place. And
wow.
another author, Kara Putman, and I both would have been the recipients of our first contract there at the conference. But because of everything that was going on, we actually got phone calls about 2 months later once they had gotten everything involved. And so it's one of those things I'm like, oh, man, I missed walking stage to get awarded a first contract in front of all my other writers and friends and everything. But that's okay. It's okay. I love the fact that I did get that first contract that year. And then, yeah, that's about 10 years ago. And, you know, now I'm definitely on a strong writing path. So,
absolutely. I would say so. And this wasn't exactly what you planned out of the gate, huh?
No, it definitely is not a plan that I had. And so, yeah, it but, you know, from a young age, I'm one of four kids. I am the second born and I'm the only girl. And I have three brothers, and two of my brothers came along when I was 8 and 13. And so there's a bit of an age gap between the age spread between myself and my brothers. I have an older brother that's really close, but I ended up playing kind of a mother figure or a backup mother to my mom, to my younger brothers. And so for most of my life, mm-hmm. I pretty much figured I would just get married. I'd raise a family. I would have my kids. I'd just kind of live that life and maybe work from home or be a housewife or something like that. But looking back now, I mean, I've watched so many women give up on their dreams and even sacrifice themselves for their children or their husbands. And then lo and behold, after 20 years or more, 30 years, they look at themselves in the mirror and they have no idea who that woman is that's staring back at them.
Yes.
And I've seen this struggle. I've seen this confusion, and I've seen it break up marriages. I've seen it cause rifts in family relationships. I've seen it destroy the bonds between mothers and children. And so although the path that my life is taking now is certainly not one that I planned, I'm very grateful for where God has led me and very grateful for where he has shown me the passions that were starting to grow, the seeds that were planted even back when I was a child. It's been amazing to see those seeds get watered and actually bloom far beyond anything I could have ever dreamed or imagined. But at least now looking at the fact that the pursuit of writing actually led me to find my husband. And I mean, the story that we have with my husband, I met him at a writer's conference in ACFW mm-hmm. back in 2004. And I mean, that was 2004. That was the year that Jim told me, you know, kind of sent that request for that proposal. And so that same year that I got the invitation or got the request to send in that proposal for my first book was the same year that I met the man that I would eventually marry at a writer's conference. And we in touch. I mean, he was out in Colorado. I was on the East Coast. And so we kept in touch via email and instant message and saw each other once a year at the conferences. And 2006 was when I kind of realized that this better go somewhere or the relationship was going to kind of end, and things happened. I got my first contract and he decided he was the first person that I told, because we had this friendship that had been building for a few years. And And then he flew out and visited me in 2007 for a few days and came out to see me. And then by the time we left, it was a lot of people laugh at this when I say, yeah, we really didn't have we definitely did not have a typical courtship or relationship building. And we just sort of, we were friends and we chatted a lot and got to know each other. He came out and he visited me. We celebrated my first contract. And by the time he, you know, he was out for 4 days, and at the end of those 4 days, we pretty much just kind of looked at each other and sort of said, do we need to talk about this? And I kind of looked at him and said, no, I'm good. And he said, yeah, I'm good. And said goodbye, you know, put him on the plane and said goodbye. And a week later, he called my dad and he asked for permission to marry me and called me and proposed to me over the phone. So some of these, you know, you look at modern technology and everything, and like, yeah, my first proposal was received over the phone, you know, I mean, and then 10 weeks later, I went out and I visited him for a week, and that was when the official down on one knee presentation of the ring and a beautiful just lights around all over the place, and he had strung up some lights and he had put some music on and he had surprised me with some candles that were lit and out on his porch of his house and had kind of drawn me out there. I had gone to freshen up or something and came out and all the lights in the place were off. And the only thing I saw was this glow out on the porch. And I'm like, oh, well, obviously we're always drawn to the light to some extent. And when we're in darkness, and so I walked toward the light, you know, and that was when he was down on one knee and flipped on, you know, some more lights out there and then proposed to me officially. But yeah, I mean, it definitely has not been a plan that I would have had, but I really am very, very grateful for where it's led me.
Oh yes, and I love your romance story. You two were known for many years as the romance couple of ACFW, if I remember right.
Oh yes, we were. We were called the darling couple of ACFW, and a lot of people, because I think we were we were the first couple to get together as a result of ACFW.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely. Well, tell us, Tiff, what you like to write. Of course, I know what you like to write because I've known you for years, but our listeners don't so much. So give us a little overview of what kind of stories you like to craft.
Well, for the most part, again, my writing and the stories that come out of my writing are a lot like where my writing career has been. It hasn't been something that I've necessarily chosen to land on, but it developed out of just my passion for family and my love for family, my love for creating family legacies, my love for history. So a lot of the stories that I choose to write are often stories where somebody is somehow connected or not connected, and then through their choices and through their actions in their lives, they leave a legacy and they leave an imprint on somebody's life. And so what you can find in a lot of my stories is going to be a connection between family generations. It could be family members they don't have to be multi-generational. It could just be leaving a legacy with somebody in, you know, a direct, whether it be a brother, a sister, or a parent. It could be nieces, nephews. It could be grandchildren. It could be great-grandchildren. My first series was, in fact, the genealogy. It was definitely multi-generational series, and it was where the heroine of the first book ended up being the mother of the heroine of the second book, and the same thing happened with the third book. So you ended up with, mm-hmm. by the end, you ended up with a grandmother, a mother, and a daughter in between those three stories. And so you had that multi-generational. And then I picked up the next set, and I ended up doing the same kind of concept where it was a mother and a daughter, but then it ended up being a nephew somewhere, and then it was a grandson, and it was mixed in where the lead characters were still connected via family in the setting. And I started to see that theme play out. And I really loved, even though, again, it was one of those things where I really did not set out to plan to write that, I really love having that be a focus in my stories, where somehow I'm tying in the importance of family, and whether it be somebody that's rediscovering their family, it could be somebody that maybe was estranged from their family and has come back and gotten back involved in the relationships. It could just be a very strong family, and how their impact on the world they live in is having on the others that are around them. But you definitely, it's a very, very strong theme. And I love to explore all the different nuances of family, whether it be blood related or not. I mean, you could even have family that just become amazing friends, and the friendship and shared commonalities link you together like being family.
Well, I know some of your books, Tiff, from looking at your website are, let me give you an example here, like Liberty's Promise. It's a collection of three separate books, right?
Yes, it is. It is
that
the first, Liberty's Promise actually is
my
call
book. It.
Right, repackaged and everything so that it becomes, repackaged so that it becomes kind of a collection anthology or whatever you want to call it. There is different terminologies for it. But yes, Liberty's Promise actually was the first repackage of my very first three books. So it was that set. And so then you can definitely, when you read Liberty's Promise, you can definitely see that theme of family flowing through all three of those stories that are included.
Yes, and that's kind of neat when you buy a book like that and it's three stories in one. It's I always like stories that are a series anyway, because when you finish the first one, you know that you're going to see those characters again in the next one. It's when you finish the last one that you feel sad. You've gotten to know the characters
yes.
so well.
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely. And one thing that I did was with Liberty's Promise was when I came back, I jumped forward from Liberty's Promise and I had changed the setting. But then my next trilogy of books came around, and it's become what's the title that's out there called Brandywine Brides. What I ended up doing was I had returned, because the first three books that I wrote were set in colonial Delaware. And then I jumped forward to Industrial Revolution in Michigan, but then I came back to Delaware in the turn of the century and the Gilded Age. So it was like late 1900s, early 2000s. Oh, no, sorry, late 1800s, early 1900s was that third trilogy that I'd written. And I ended up tying those stories back to the first set of stories that I wrote. And I had brought in a book that was mentioned in the very first book that I wrote. There was a book that was mentioned that some of the characters were reading. And I ended up tying that into that third series, and that book became integral in the plot of all three of the books in that third trilogy. And so then I then got back to that family legacy and that generational connection and tied those two series together. So even though you said goodbye to the characters in Deceptive Promises, which was my third book, you were then able to come back, and there was references dropped in the series of Brandywine Brides to those books. So then you got to see the characters and got to know them a little bit and mention them all over again. So see, they sometimes you don't have to say goodbye to characters, and sometimes you're going to end up seeing them again.
That's pretty amazing that you were able to do that. Tiff, I'm going to take just a little break from our discussion here real quick to let folks know. A lot of times on Blog Talk Radio, people come into a show in the middle of the show and they don't know what they're listening to. So I would like to make listeners aware that you are listening to Step Into the Light. I am your host, Patty Sheen. Our guest this morning is Tiffany Amber Stockton. She is a multi-published author, and we have been talking about her, how she got into the business of writing and what she likes to write, and we have much more to come. Tiffany has a website, a Facebook page, and a Twitter page, and I also have a website, which is Patty Sheen, PattiSheene.com. If you go to that website, you will find under the Blog Talk Radio tab a page that is called Website and Social Media Information, and it has the contact information for all of the guests that I've had here on the show, and I'll have Tiffany's up by this afternoon. So please go and browse that website. If you missed any part of the show or you'd like to refer it to others, or you'd like to listen to it again, whatever, it will be found on archive on that same website. In fact, the first page has a link to the show, and it's the same link now as it is on archive. So you'll be able to get to it fairly easily. And I want to thank you all for listening. So let's get back to Tiffany. Tiff, one of the signatures of your writing is that you do very well weave research into your stories without what we call information dumping, just giving us paragraphs and paragraphs of history. But you kind of weave it through. How do you do that? And what have you learned about research in general?
Well, research is, and I recently have given a talk on this about research and how to do that and incorporate it. Research is definitely essential, especially when you write, whether you write historical or contemporary, you're always going to end up having to research something. And certain books will give rise to more in-depth research. Certain books you'll be able to just write what you know. And that is often a mantra that you hear when you get started in writing, is write what you know, because writing can be quite a challenge, and it can certainly cause you to doubt yourself. It can cause you to hesitate on whether you have enough knowledge, whether this book is going to be a good book. And so when you get encouraged to write what you know, a lot of times you can write from a point of knowledge that will allow that story to take shape and at least flow fairly smoothly, and you won't need to research as much. But research still becomes quite essential in everything that you're doing. And it's, I almost want to call it, you know, it's kind of a, I don't want to say a necessary evil, but it can become, you know, a little bit of a challenge. And when you're writing historical fiction, obviously you have to get the nuances of the time period and the clothing and the mannerisms, and there's so many details that go into historical fiction. But and you can get so excited about the stuff that you discover that when you go to write, you just have so much knowledge and so much information, whether in your notes or stored up in your head, that it's so easy to just dump it into your story. But the problem is that when the reader comes back in, they get to that part, and I know I'm definitely one of these types of readers when I read a story, that if I see paragraph upon paragraph upon paragraph back to back that is just information about the setting or about the people or their backstory, or I'll be honest, I flip the pages until the story starts getting active again. And so I'm not one that will enjoy long paragraphs of information. And so knowing that as a reader I don't like that, there's a lot of changes that I've made to the research that I've done. And I know I'm certainly not the only one that can speak on research. There is plenty of others, but my personal take on things is that you need to take all of this research. It's very, very critical that you have the research, but it's very important that you don't overwhelm the reader with the research, because you want that reader to discover the research a lot like you did. A lot of times when, as an author and as a writer, as you're doing research, you're not necessarily just picking up one book and getting every answer to every question that you've had in that one book. A lot of times you've got multiple resources, you've got multiple books, sites, people. Your research comes from a lot of different places. And so instead of putting all of that information into and just dumping it, you want to sprinkle it throughout. And the analogy that I recently used, that I often use when I talk about research, is you don't want to take it, it's kind of like making a slow simmering stew. And you don't want to just dump everything in at the beginning and turn on the heat and let it simmer for hours right at the beginning, because you're going to have spices and you're going to have flavors and things that are going to benefit that stew by putting them in at different points of the simmering process. And so the same thing goes for your books. You're going to have information and research that is not going to benefit the reader right at the beginning of the story, because they just don't need to know that information yet. It's not important to the character or the story, or the character just isn't at a point where that research is going to be beneficial. That information, that backstory, that bit of details that you found may not be important at that point. And so, but if you get it put in maybe in the middle of the story or even closer to the end, it packs a much more powerful punch in the story and brings the story alive and gives it the flavor that wouldn't have happened if you had put it in earlier, because maybe by the time you need that information, the newness or the freshness or the fire in that seasoning has lost its punch and it's just not as strong anymore. Mm-hmm. And so when I look at my research and everything, what I try to do is I try to sprinkle it a little bit as I go, and I throw it in to a little bit of the dialogue into the background, into the narrative, and so it ends up being woven into the story throughout the progression from start to finish in the book.
Yeah, that's excellent advice, Tiffany. Thank you for that. Of course, I've heard it from you before because I was at the ACFW meeting where you spoke. But for our listeners, it's very good advice, and thank you. Well, Tiff, as you know, the premise of this show itself is stepping into the light, finding your way out of a period of darkness. And I haven't met a writer yet who has not been through one, a period of darkness, of discouragement, of whatever. So if you would you share with us a dark time that was difficult for you and how you found your way back out of that?
Sure. Oh, yeah, definitely. And a lot of times they talk about writers and the strongest writing comes out of your darkest moments. And it's kind of the concept of it's always darkest before the dawn. And you look at, you write out of your pain sometimes. And if you're willing to be transparent enough, your story will resonate even deeper with readers. And so for me, I allude a little bit to a dark moment in my life with that one lady at the church that had spoken to me and sort of shot my dreams down, you know, in a profound way. And that's a little bit that kind of dark cloud from her words. And I even now, and I still struggle with it. I mean, even 20 years later, after she said that, I still deal with some doubts sometimes about my age. And because I wasn't even 30 yet when I got my first contract. And so a lot of writers that I run into and that I encounter discover that they wanted to write or set out that they wanted to write after their kids were grown, after their kids are out of the house. And so a lot of them are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And here I am in my 20s and I've gotten my first contract. And so being younger definitely comes with both benefits and challenges, but at times I might consider that a little bit of a stumbling block, but sometimes I also wonder how much of what I'm considering to be a stumbling block is actually still some hangovers from what that woman had said to me back right after college. And you know, and then I also, even with my family, I mean, yeah, I had in my head, I'm thinking I'm going to become a mother, I'm going to become or a wife and a mother, and I'm going to raise my kids in my 20s. And then a husband and kids didn't come in my 20s. They didn't come until my 30s. And so here I am. I've already got my writing career going. My speaking career is kind of starting a little bit. And now the husband and the kids come. So now I've got a career that needs my attention, but now I've got a husband that needs my attention. I've got kids that need my attention. And so for the past 8 years, it has definitely been I don't know that I want to call my kids or my husband and family. I don't know that I want to call them a stumbling block, but it definitely has been a challenge trying to strike the balance of the demands of having young kids and having a somewhat of a younger, you know, a new marriage anyway, and in mixing it in with the demands of writing and speaking and the times where I'm on a deadline and I just have to close my door and say, you know, mommy's still here, I still love you, but you're just going to have to go and entertain yourself and find something to do. And as soon as I'm done this deadline, mm-hmm. then we'll have lots of fun. And So a lot of, and a lot of what I have done has been where I've locked that door and I've had to get that deadline done, but then I've dealt with just, I've heaped guilt on myself that they're my babies, they're my young kids, they need mommy, and so then I know that my writing has taken a bit more of a hit, as far as I look back at some of my stories and I realize that they just aren't, they're not as great as they could have been had my mind been more in them and not been so divided with the kids. And so, but it's okay. I look back and I try now not to allow those types of doubts to take over for long. I mean, everywhere we look, there's negative. Everywhere we look, there's doubt. Everywhere we look, we're being attacked from all sides. And we need to realize that attack is coming because God's got plans for our lives that we may not see. But those plans are something where we don't see it. We don't know what impact our lives are going to have. And the devil's out there going, I can see where this might happen. I can see where you're going to be a powerful force for God, and I don't want that to happen. So I'm going to throw these stumbling blocks into your life, and I'm going to try and distract you and get you off of that path. And so you've got to stay. One thing that has definitely helped me has been flooding my life, flooding my everything around me with positive. I have done personal development books. I've done motivational DVDs, CDs, listening to other speakers. I have pored over the scriptures. I have really gone and looked for uplifting music, and I grew up with it. My parents did it a lot as I was growing up, and I know without a doubt that even though I've had these stumbling blocks, that positive influence has made a drastic difference in my ability to handle those stumbling blocks and those dark points in my life where I get down into a point of doubt, I get down into a point of blaming myself, I get down into guilt, and I start allowing that stuff to distract me away from where God has. And but then I get back into that positive and I go, no, and I put my foot down and say, devil, you're not going to win, and I break away from the things, those strongholds that are holding on to me. And obviously that seems very simplistic. It certainly is not as easy as I'm making it sound here in what I'm talking. Obviously it comes with a lot of soul searching. It comes with some time alone. It comes with seeking out wisdom from other people who have walked that path before you. But it definitely, those stumbling blocks, you can decide whether they're going to become stumbling blocks or stepping stones. And you can let them distract you, or you can step up on top of them, get a new perspective, get a new viewpoint, step up higher and get yourself up out of the pit and see that there is a whole bright new world, you know, if you just jump over that hurdle.
And I've heard it said that, I'm sure you have too, that discouragement is the devil's greatest weapon, most powerful weapon.
Oh, definitely.
And he has so many ways of throwing that right in our path.
Yes, because if he can discourage you and he can get you doubting your ability or doubting your impact, then he definitely has won that battle, and he has gotten you off the path of where God might have you to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, Tiff, I know that in addition to your writing career, you are also involved in a business venture. And I know you were excited to share that with us. Could you tell us a little bit about the product that you represent and what it does for folks and why you endorse it?
Sure. Yeah. I grew up all of my life. I grew up around the direct selling industry. I grew up around the entrepreneurs. I grew up around that influence of people that were out there seeking something better than that 9-to-5, something better than watching their dreams disappear and as they work for somebody else and help build somebody else's dreams. And there's a saying out there saying, if you don't build your own dreams and you don't pursue your own dreams, then somebody else is going to hire you to build theirs. And so even though I have worked a lot of jobs, yeah, now it kind of hits you hard when you think about that. But if you don't go after what you want, then somebody else will you know, will use you to pursue what they want. And so you're working for somebody and you're just not seeing much benefit. You're not seeing much happening, but not saying, and I'm certainly not shooting down the jobs. I've had lots of jobs. I've been working since I was 15 and, you know, full-time, part-time. I've had, at a point, I had three jobs at one time. But even throughout all of that, because I grew up around entrepreneurs, because I grew up around business owners, I always knew that somewhere I would do something on my own. I didn't know what, but I knew I would do something on my own where I had a business. And obviously becoming an author, becoming a speaker has its own business side and the importance of that. But I knew that if I could find a company and find a product that I could get behind, something that I really loved, something that I believed in, I would go for it full bore. And I knew that, but because I grew up around that industry, I was also extremely selective. And so I would host parties upon parties upon parties for all of my friends that were getting involved in all of these businesses that were out there. And I would get to know the products, I'd get to know the company, but I was extremely careful about and about what the choices that I made. And I often had people that would say, well, you know, you should, you know, join my team. And I had invites upon invites. And I kept looking at going, no, it's just not clicking. And then about three years ago, I was introduced to a company called Nerium International. And it's Nerium. A lot of times we get joked, you know, people just, they don't hear us correctly. They go, Nexium? Or they'll tell me, you know, and I go, no, it's not that. I don't help people with their heartburn, and what I represent is not a purple pill, and you know, so it's kind of fun, and I make jokes with it and everything, but that company was introduced to me, and compiling on back with how I was raised with that positive influence and the motivational books and the tapes and the CDs and the personal development and just these people that had these big dreams that were guiding them and driving them. I saw in Nerium and the CEO and the leadership team, I saw that same vision. I saw that this larger than life concept. And I also saw it didn't take long at all for me to see that at the core of this company is a drive and a desire to make people better. And so the products do drive the success of the company, sure. They drive the profits, and that's going to be the same no matter what company you deal with. You've got to make a profit or you're going to be gone. But the culture that gets created by the leadership of a company is also extremely critical when you are picking and choosing where you're going to go and where you're going to invest your money. The same can be said of a job. I mean, you could maybe have the most monotonous job in the world, but if the culture led by the CEO and the managers and the owners is a positive work atmosphere, you're going to love it. I mean, you know, you're going to love the people that you're around. And so the same can be said about my choice. I finally realized that with Nerium that I had found a company that matched where I felt was a good path forward. They really had a strong vision. They had a very, very strong core of family. They had a strong core of unity. They had a strong core of making people better, of doing whatever it was, or whatever it is that you can to leave whoever it is that you meet better than when they met you. And it may not be with a product. You know, I mean, you may run into somebody and they never become a customer, and that's okay. But you might leave them with something that is going to encourage them and inspire them to become a better version of themselves. And that is at the core of the company. And so one thing, they started out with skincare, and because they were setting out to heal skin cancer is what their goal was. So their company and the biotech company that we partnered with, that was their goal. And so they had a lot of people that were using the products and they were trying to heal the skin cancer, and they still are. They still haven't quite found it yet, but they're getting closer. But as a result of some of these products, they realized they had people go, well, you know, my skin cancer isn't gone, but can I have some of that moisturizing cream you've been giving me? Because my skin feels amazing. And so they got done and they went, oh, well, maybe we have something. And this certainly isn't. So they didn't set out to have any kind of anti-aging, amazing skincare or anything like that. It was all by accident. And honestly, there's lots of products that are out there that come about as accidents where they set out to do one thing and they end up with a whole different result. I mean, you look at Latisse. Latisse is out there with these lashes that just make your eyelashes, you know, magnify in volume and everything. They just look amazing. That initially was the initial research on that was for glaucoma medicine. And so they were trying to fix glaucoma and help people with glaucoma. And all of a sudden they realized the side effect of what they had researched was these major lashes, absolutely stunningly amazing. And so Nerium has that kind of that similar story. And so they come back with, you know, they've got this amazing anti-aging cream and lots of people use skincare and lots of people take care of their skin. They keep it cleansed. They keep it clean and moisturized. Nerium has, they have what has become, you know, it's one bottle. It's a skincare system in a bottle. So it's a night cream. It's a day cream. You get 24 hours of protection. And that, those two products alone, the first product launched them to $100 million in sales in 1 year.
Wow.
With one product in one country. So they did that. They did that much, and they've been breaking records left and right. They launched the day cream about 2 years after they launched the night cream. Then they came on with – they had people that were taking that skincare, and they were – instead of putting it on their face, they were putting it on the rest of their body because they were getting amazing results. So they came out with a firming body contour cream. Then they, through partnerships with some scientists at Princeton University in 2015, they realized that skincare is really important, but we also need to be taking care of the insides of our body. And so they ended up, through research, coming out with an anti-aging brain supplement called EHT, and that launched in 2015. And that has been having – the skincare has been doing amazing with giving restoring people's confidence in their appearance. But the EHT has been working from the inside out, and so it's been helping people that had given up hope that their life, whatever they're struggling with, whatever brain issues that are impeding them, that are causing them to be, you know, not living or acting at their fullest potential because they've got something going on, whether it be PTSD, whether it be ADHD, whether it be Parkinson's, it could be MS, it could be dementia, early onset stages of Alzheimer's. It could be, you know, the scientists at Princeton, basically their research on EHT came about because they said they had two concepts. They had one concept, and the biggest concept that drove their research was our bodies are not designed to fail. They are designed to work, and they are designed to work in tandem. And if they're not at their, they're not performing at their peak performance level, then there's something wrong. And you can almost always trace that back to the brain somehow, because the brain is the epicenter of what drives our body. And so if something's not working, you can usually trace it back there. And so through 20 years of research on the brain, the scientists at Princeton University came out with this EHT. They had pharmaceutical companies banging down their door, opening their checkbook, saying, I will give you whatever you ask for to get the rights to this product. And they said, no way. We're not going to go the pharmaceutical route. We're not going to do that because what we've discovered is going to get buried. And it's either going to get buried or tampered with, or drugs are going to get added, or something's going to happen and it's going to mess up this formula. And so they actually chose Nerium. So they actually contacted our CEO and they said, we want you to become our mouth. We want you to distribute this product for us. And so we did. And when that product launched, it did $1 million in sales in less than 24 hours.
Gee.
And
that's,
it has
successful.
Only gone. Yes, it has only gone up since then, and it has made major impact. And I've loved sharing this brain supplement because I've seen all of the amazing benefits that have come from the people that have gotten on this supplement, and you know, it's just been wonderful to see their lives and see how great their lives have changed and how much they almost have a new lease on life. And it's just been awesome to have people come back and pick up the phone and come back and see me and call me or whatever and just tell me how awesome it is that they have gotten something, you know, long term now that is bringing them so much benefit, and you know, in areas where they really had given up hope. And that's, so again, you know, tying it back into that positive influence and tying it back into that making people better.
Yes.
You know, this company really comes alongside of everything that I love and allows me to possibly offer a product. If the product doesn't meet your needs, that's fine. You know, it's fine either way. It doesn't affect me either way, but at least I know that as a result of our conversation, there's been something I've been able to share that has uplifted you in some way and set you on a more positive path after we say goodbye.
Yes, yes. And let me bring up to our listeners that I guess you can learn more about this product on your website, right, Tiff, under the Eagle Enterprises tab?
Yep, all of my writing, my speaking, the business ventures, anything where I've got my business from home, all of it is under Eagle Enterprises. And so everything about what I do, you know, is all tied in through that. And that's you know, Eagles have always long been an inspiration to me because, and I won't go into a whole lot of detail about how it came about, but basically I realized that Eagles, when a storm comes and the clouds darken and everything and the rain's pouring down, most animals out in the wild will hunker down. They'll go find shelter. They'll go hide to wait out the storm and wait until the storm passes.
Mm-hmm.
But eagles are one of the few animals that will be out there, and they actually will dive up through the clouds, through the storm, through the rain, until they can get up above the storm so that they can soar into the blue skies. And so their natural instincts has always motivated and always inspired me to that. Sometimes you can't let that storm keep you down. You can't just ride the storm out and wait till it passes. Sometimes you have to go through that storm to get up above and get on the other side where the blue skies are there. Because you've then become stronger because you fought your way through the storm and not just allowed the storm to keep you down on the ground. And so eagles then became my symbol through so much of what I do. And that's how Eagle Enterprises is kind of tied in.
And how funny, because that was the question I was going to ask you, how you came up with the title Eagle Enterprises, because I know you used to have a website business, which was Eagle Designs. So obviously the eagle had some significance for you, and you answered that question without me even asking. Yeah, I see at the top of the page on the Eagle Designs page of your site where you can click to buy products.
Yes. Yep.
Deal. And yeah, I'll have to check that out more after I get off of the show, Tiffany. I was looking at it somewhat last night, but I'd like to investigate that further.
Yeah, definitely.
Well,
and it's, you know, like I said, it's definitely something that it's fun. I mean, it's, you know, all of what I do is, I love seeing it all tied together. And it's awesome that whether it be through my books, whether it be through my speaking, whether it be through partnering with Nerium International, and the excitement of what's coming down the pike with Nerium is amazing, because in January we now are going to be moving. We've gone from skincare, we've gone into comprehensive anti-aging, and now we're going to be shifting a little bit where we're going to be going into total body wellness in January. And there's a major, major global announcement that's going to happen with our company on January 6th. And so we're building up to that excitement point where we now have partnered with a company over in Asia that has been known for decades for being a major company in the herbal medicine type side. And so Asians have long been known for their herbal benefits and herbal remedies and how they have maintained their youth, and they look amazing and they stay healthy, and they, you know, that visibly they're not aging as much as most of the rest of the world, And so there's some secrets that are over there in Asia and some of the botanical products that are over there. And so we've partnered with a company over there now. So not only do we have the scientists at Princeton University that are on the cutting edge of Western medicine, but now we've got Eastern or Western science, but now we've got the Eastern medicine benefits in the company over there that are going to come together. So the product we have in January is going to be the very first product that's going to be a blend of Eastern medicine and Western science, taking us into the wellness category. So it's just going to be an exciting time that's going to and a major global announcement, you know, because we're in six other countries right now, but we're going to be expanding down into South America and Europe in 2017. And so we're going to be taking our impact and everything out, you know, even further globally. So it's definitely an awesome, awesome time.
Well, that sounds really exciting to be a part of such a venture, Tiff. And thank you for sharing that with us. And I have to say, we're about at the end of our show here. It's been wonderful to have you with us today, Tiffany. You've talked not only about your writing, but about your Venereum products, and you have shared a great deal with us, and we certainly appreciate your time.
It's been a wonderful pleasure to chat with you and to reach out to listeners all around. You know, the wonderful thing about Blog Talk Radio is anybody from anywhere can listen. It's not just those who are limited to a local radio station. So it's fantastic to know that you can have an impact on somebody that's, you know, miles and thousands of miles and hours away.
That's the very neat thing about it. All righty, well, until next time, Tiffany, I'll be back in touch with you and listeners. Until next time, we sure enjoyed having you with us today, and we will be here again next Tuesday. But in the meantime, when you look back on the dark periods in your life, you may find they were not quite as dark as they seemed at the time. And when the light does shine again, it is so much brighter than you remembered. Thank you for spending time with us this morning. We'll look forward to having you back next Tuesday at 8 a.m. Mountain Standard Time. Have a nice Thanksgiving, everyone, and God bless you all.